Okay, so the notes for chapter 13 are coming around, and I thought what we'd do is begin with 13, and then if we get into 14, well and good. We've got probably three or four more weeks in 1 Kings, and then we jump into 2 Kings, which is about 25 chapters long, so maybe 10 more weeks of that. So
we got a ways.
I am too, trust me.
Can we
leave them? I could do a 2 Kings in 30 minutes thing.
Okay.
That's not necessarily a bad idea.
All right, yeah, no. And on Sunday morning, we're going to start a new course on sin, how to do it better. And so 9 o'clock right here, hot breakfast. We're probably going to spend 6 to 7 weeks on sin. And then the group decided on Sunday morning that after that, we'd like to spend 7 to 8 weeks on the Psalms. And, of course, you can't go through the Psalms one at a time, because that would take you 3 years. So when I've taught it before, what I've done is I've divided it into the categories of Psalms, using just a few Psalms as exemplars. So, for instance, the majority of the 150 Psalms are Psalms of lament, where people are crying out to God in distress for relief. But there are also Psalms of thanksgiving. There are what are known as pilgrimage Psalms. Psalm 121 and Psalm 122 are examples of that. There are instructional Psalms where the history of the people of Israel is recounted in verse form. So that's how we'll be doing that on Sunday morning. But for the next month and a half or so, we're going to talk about sin. In a way, this is kind of a preview, because in chapter 13 we see plenty of sin. No surprise, as we've been working through Samuel and Kings for the last half year. So we'll just start by reading of chapter 13 and go from there. While Jeroboam was standing by the altar to offer incense, a man of God came out of Judah by the word of the Lord to Bethel and proclaimed against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who offer incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you. He gave a sign the same day, saying, This is the sign that the Lord has spoken. The altar shall be torn down, and the ashes that are on it shall be poured out. When the king heard what the man of God cried out against the altar at Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, Seize him! But the hand that he stretched out against him withered, so that he could not draw it back to himself. The altar also was torn down, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign that the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. The king said to the man of God, Entreat now the favor of the Lord your God, and pray for me, so that my hand may be restored to me. So the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him, and became as it was before. Then the king said to the man of God, Come home with me and dine, and I will give you a gift. But the man of God said to the king, If you give me half your kingdom, I will not go in with you, nor will I eat food or drink water in this place. For thus I was commanded by the word of the Lord, You shall not eat food or drink water, or return by the way that you came. So he went another way, and did not return by the way that he had come to Bethel. Now there lived an old prophet in Bethel. One of his sons came and told him all that the man of God had done that day in Bethel, the words also that he had spoken to the king, they told to their father. Their father said to him, them, which way did he go? And his sons showed him the way that the man of God who came from Judah had gone. Then he said to his sons, Saddle a donkey for me. So they saddled a donkey for him, and he mounted it. He went after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak tree. He said to him, Are you the man of God who came from Judah? He answered, I am. Then he said to him, Come home with me and eat some food. But he said, I cannot return with you or go in with you, nor will I eat food or drink water with you in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, You shall not eat food or drink water there, or return by the way that you came. Then the other said to him, I also am a prophet, as you are, and an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, Bring him back with you into your house, so that he may eat food and drink water. but he was deceiving him. Then the man of God went back with him and ate food and drank water in his house. As they were sitting at the table, the word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back, and he proclaimed to the man of God who came from Judah, "Thus says the Lord, because you have disobeyed the word of the Lord and have not kept the commandment that the Lord your God commanded you, but have come back and eaten food and drunk water in the place of which he said to you, 'Eat no food and drink no water,' your body shall not come to your ancestral tomb." After the man of God had eaten food and had drunk, they saddled for him a donkey belonging to the prophet who had brought him back. Then as he went away, a lion met him on the road and killed him. His body was thrown in the road, and the donkey stood beside it. The lion also stood beside the body. People passed by and saw the body thrown in the road with the lion standing by the body, and they came and told it in the town where the old prophet lived. When the prophet who had brought him back from the way heard of it, he said, "It is the man of God who disobeyed the word of the Lord. Therefore the Lord has given him to the lion, which has torn him and killed him according to the word that the Lord spoke to him." Then he said to his sons, "Saddle a donkey for me." So they saddled one, and he went and found the body thrown in the road with the donkey and the lion standing beside the body. The lion had not eaten the body or attacked the donkey. The prophet took up the body of the man of God, laid it on the donkey, and brought it back to the city to mourn and to bury him. He laid the body in his own grave, and they mourned over him, saying, "Alas, my brother." After he had buried him, he said to his sons, "When I die, bury me in the grave in which the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones. For the saying that he proclaimed by the word of the Lord against the altar in Bethel, and against all the houses of the high places that are in the cities of Samaria, shall surely come to pass." Even after this event, Jeroboam did not turn from his evil way, but made priests for the high places again from among all the people. Any who wanted to be priests, he consecrated for the high places. This matter became sin to the house of Jeroboam, so as to cut it off and to destroy it from the face of the earth. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. As we left off in chapter 12, Jeroboam has invented a new feast day. He has set up altars in different places because he's afraid that without some sort of alternative, the people will continue to return to the temple in Jerusalem for worship, and that will jeopardize the integrity of Israel and threaten his reign as king. So he's standing by ready to offer some incense, and an anonymous person, simply identified as a man of God, which often indicates a prophet, though it's not given explicitly here, comes from Judah. And so this is a messenger coming up from Judah to Israel. And the reason for that is probably that God's name still resides in Jerusalem. He still shows favor to the house of David. So the power and authority still resides there. So this guy comes up and he says, 3 centuries from now, well, he doesn't say that in the text, but Josiah isn't coming along for another 3 centuries. So this is a far distant prophecy. And a scion of the house of David, Josiah, is going to come, and he's going to take all the priests you're making, sacrifice them on these abominable altars that you've made, and burn them up. And of course, human sacrifice was an enormous taboo. So this was a sign of God's rage against them. And he said, in the meantime, just to make you know that God's serious, and I'm telling you the truth, this altar is going to be destroyed. Jeroboam wasn't having any of this, and he says, seize him, and he even reaches out his own hand to grab hold of the guy, and his hand just withers. And apparently he lost all motor control because he couldn't even bring it back. And the altar was torn down, this gives the man of God, more weight. And Jeroboam says, "Hey, could you heal my hand? Could you talk to God about it?" The man of God does talk to the Lord, and he restores the hand. And the king says, "Why don't you come home, have a little dinner? I've got a present for you." But he refuses. And hospitality was a really big deal at that time and place. And to not offer hospitality was a terrible thing, and to not accept it was almost as bad. But the prophet explained that God had said, while you're up in Israel, you can't accept any food or water or any type of hospitality. You can't even go back the way you came, which sort of reminds me of the wise men in the birth story of Jesus. And so he leaves, and there's an old prophet in Bethel who hears about what this guy has said and done from his sons, and he decides to chase after him, and he finds him and invites him to his home. And this prophet says, you know, same thing as he said to Jeroboam. And then this old prophet from Bethel makes up a prophecy. He just bold-faced lies to this guy. He says, well, you know, an angel brought me a message that said it was okay now for you to come and have some food and some water and get some shelter in my house. So, you know, the guy says, oh, well, yeah, you're a prophet, so, I mean, if that's what God told you, you know, is the way it ought to be, I'll do that. So they go back and, you know, right in the middle of dinner, this false-ish prophet from Bethel says, you didn't do what God wanted you to do, and because of this, you're going to be struck down. It's just, why he did this, nobody knows. Maybe he didn't like being upstaged. Maybe he was loyal to Jeroboam, and he didn't like what the guy had to say and what he did. But whatever the case, this prophet from Bethel basically killed this Judean for all intents and purposes. So the Judean saddles up, and as he goes along, a lion kills him. And you see animals killing people a lot in Kings. My favorite being when the she-bear comes down to kill a number of children who were taunting Elijah because he was bald. The moral of that story escapes me completely, although I suppose, at the very least, we should not mock bald people.
Table 2 is a little bit upset.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bud likes the she-bears. Go she-bears. So, the lion doesn't eat the donkey or the man, which is unusual. And this, again, probably showing that this is a supernatural act. It's not just something that happens from time to time, but this was a God-ordained death. And so the prophet at Bethel hears about it, goes up, takes the body, maybe out of remorse, I don't know, takes it home, mourns and buries him, and then tells, and even refers to him as, alas, my brother, you know, tells his sons, when I die, put me in the same grave. Despite all this, at the end of the chapter, Jeroboam keeps on doing what he's been doing. He's heard the prophecy from the Lord. His hand has been withered and then healed. The altar that he constructed at Bethel was destroyed. And he keeps building more. And he keeps making priests, non-Levitical priests. And basically, it seems like anybody who wanted to be a priest could be a priest. And maybe he did that to cement their loyalty. Maybe there was a fee involved. The text doesn't suggest that, but you've got to wonder. So he doubles down. Even after everything that's happened, including the fact that the man of God from Judea, having disobeyed God on the basis of someone lying to him, a prophet that you would think might be trustworthy, he was killed for disobeying God. So then how much more will Jeroboam and his descendants be punished for what he's doing? Because at least he's doing what he's doing, not because he was tricked, but because he's trying to establish religious centers of worship to maintain the coherence of Israel and to keep people from being seduced by his new enemy, the southern kingdom of Judah. So, it just a lot of nasty, funky stuff going on in chapter 13. And if you got any questions or you're seeing stuff I'm not, lay it on the table.
Is the second prophet the old prophet? Is he
It says from Bethel, I mean, was he a prophet, as we know?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of people whose names were not given who were prophets. We talked about this a little bit last week, that these people kind of float in and out, and you never hear from them again. So the prophecy has definitely been established. But some are more enduring and influential than others. And so you have prophets like Samuel, and then later on we'll encounter prophets like Elijah and Elisha, who had fascinating ministries. But at the same time, there were a number of prophets who were just kind of around. You might remember way back in Samuel where Saul encountered prophets in ecstatic states and was actually caught up in that. So these prophets were around. And there's some suggestion that even though this prophet of Bethel was able to accurately pronounce God's wrath on the man of God from Judea, that in a way he was a false prophet, because initially he lied. He made up an angelic message to induce this man of God to violate God's command. This is foreshadowing a situation where in Israel prophets will become just as corrupt as the kings. And as you go down several generations to Ahab, what you see are many, many prophets, numbering into the hundreds, all of whom are false and are telling the kings of Israel pretty much what they want to hear. So just as the prediction has been made about Josiah 300 years hence, who will become king of Judah and have a major impact on Israel, so also this Bethel prophet is probably a foreshadowing of the proliferation of lion prophets that are going to be emerging in Israel over the course of time.
Lion has an interesting thing. Why would the old prophet lie? He may have been testing the man from Judah to see if his message was in fact from the Lord. The man from Judah failed to prove his message by his own obedience to it. The old prophet could announce a second, more dramatic test of truth, the man's judgment. If he survived and returned home, his word of Bethel would have been meaningless, since God would have taken no steps to punish his disobedience. But his death would prove God cared about the integrity of his message, and would warn Jeroboam that disobedience carried an awful price.
No, I think that's exactly accurate. And maybe, you know, we've talked a lot about the interplay between human free will and God's purposes and God's willingness to promote divine purposes without a lot of regard as to who gets hurt or to how it happens. And God works through errant human behavior to cause his purposes to be accomplished. And so one of the commentaries that I consult, and the quotations in your notes, is basically the way Siow looks at it, is that the fate of the man of God should have been an object lesson to Jeroboam. The story was the word of the Lord. The man of God who had prophesied the truth, who had tried so assiduously to obey the Lord, but was finally tricked into disobedience, was slain for his disobedience. How much more certainly would a blatant sinner like Jeroboam be punished? And so it's possible that the Judeans' inability to sort of see through this blatant lie, you might attribute it to some sort of hard-heartedness, or maybe some weakness. I mean, it's tough, you know, to go without food and water and shelter for a period of time. And so maybe there was a physical weakness here on his part that he succumbed to because he had been given some hope for relief. But, you know, the commandment of God cannot be violated. It doesn't matter by whom. And it doesn't matter to what degree. The covenant must be kept or consequences will follow. And so that's how I see it, is that the fate of this Judean man of God was an object lesson to Jeroboam and it totally went over his head. Because he was so focused on engineering the loyalty of his people, even if it meant committing blasphemy.
The lion, especially the lion with the house of Judah.
Yes, it's not a coincidence that it was a lion.
Yeah.
And we'll continue to see lions killing people through the rest of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. You know, the lion of the tribe of Judah is something that you find later on in the exilic prophets like Isaiah and whatnot. And of course, then that symbol of a sort of a apex predator becomes associated with the Jewish expectation of who the Messiah will be and what the Messiah will do. Yeah. Well, you know, I think he sort of started out as a Moses figure because Rehoboam was definitely being cast as a Pharaoh figure. You know, back in chapter 12, he consulted his father's advisors and they said, you know, it would be good for us to have a period of calm and lighten the yoke a little bit. And then he went and he sort of talked to his own cohort of advisors, and they said, no, make it worse. You know, they're being very presumptuous to tell you what to do, and so that's what Rehoboam did. And so you have Jeroboam acting as sort of a liberator from this sort of Pharaoh-type character, but then he quickly turns into more of an Aaron-type character, constructing golden calves. Unlike Aaron, who repented, you may remember from our study of Exodus that he ground down the golden calves into a powder, and everyone who contributed it toward their construction by giving their jewelry and whatnot had to drink it. Jeroboam sort of never makes the turn back to faithfulness that Aaron did. I mean, there are all kinds of echoes from the Exodus story here. What?
I think they're discussing sins on Sunday.
Yeah.
This makes you feel a lot better.
I was going to say, yeah. One of the benefits of reading through Samuel and Kings is, you know, well, I could be doing worse. But we can't, you know, look down our noses at these people. They had the same weaknesses and predilection to sin as we do. It's just in the case of people like Rehoboam and Jeroboam, they had a lot more power. With great power comes great responsibility, and immense risk because of the capacity for corruption and the arrogance that power brings that makes you begin to believe that you know, you're co-equal with God. Well, you want to jump into 14? It's pretty much a continuation of what we've got going on in 13, only worse. You're like, could it get worse? At that time, Abijah, son of Jeroboam, fell sick. Jeroboam said to his wife, "Go, disguise yourself, so that it will not be known that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh, for the prophet Ahijah is there, who said of me that I should be king over this people. Take with you 10 loaves, some cakes, and a jar of honey, and go to him. He will tell you what shall happen to the child." Jeroboam's wife did so. She set out and went to Shiloh and came to the house of Ahijah. Now Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were dim because of his age. But the Lord said to Ahijah, "The wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. Thus and thus you shall say to her." When she came, she pretended to be another woman. But when Ahijah heard the sound of her feet As she came in at the door, he said, "Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another? For I am charged with heavy tidings for you. Go tell Jeroboam, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people, made you leader over my people Israel, and tore the kingdom away from the house of David to give it to you. Yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and followed me with all his heart, doing only that which was right in my sight. But you have done evil above all those who were before you, and have gone and made for yourself other gods and cast images, provoking me to anger, and have thrust me behind your back. Therefore I will bring evil upon the house of Jeroboam. I will cut off from Jeroboam every male, both bond and free in Israel, and will consume the house of Jeroboam just as one burns up dung until it is gone. Anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dog shall eat. And anyone who dies in the open country, the birds of the air shall eat, for the Lord has spoken. Therefore set out, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die. All Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, for he alone of Jeroboam's family shall come to the grave, because in him there is found something pleasing to the Lord, the God of Israel and the house of Jeroboam. Moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam today, even right now. The Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. He will root up Israel out of this good land that he gave to their ancestors and scatter them beyond the Euphrates because they have made their sacred poles, provoking the Lord to anger. He will give up Israel because of the sins of Jeroboam, which he sinned and which caused Israel to commit." Then Jeroboam's wife got up and went away, and she came to Tirzah. As she came to the threshold of the house, the child died. All Israel buried him and mourned for him according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant, the prophet Ahijah. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he warred and how he reigned, are written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel. The time that Jeroboam reigned was 22 years. Then he slept with his ancestors, and his son Nadab succeeded him. Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. Judah did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed, more than all that their ancestors had done. For they also built for themselves high places, pillars, and sacred poles on every high hill and under every green tree. There were also male temple prostitutes in the land. They committed all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, King Shishak of Egypt came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took everything. He also took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made. So Rehoboam made shields of bronze instead and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. As often as the king went into the house of the Lord, the guard carried them and brought them back into the guard room. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? There was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually. Rehoboam slept with his ancestors and was buried with his ancestors in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. His son Abijam succeeded him. The word of the Lord.
So the punishment for Jeroboam continues. He's going to lose his son.
And this is sort of reminiscent of the death of the firstborn in Egypt as a punishment for the great sin of Pharaoh and really of all Egypt and the oppression of the peoples. And the son is sick, Abijah, and Jeroboam sends his wife to talk to a prophet at Shiloh, another ancient sacred place. But he wants her to go disguised. He doesn't want the prophet to know that the king's asking. Maybe it was a prestige thing that, you know, he didn't want to be seen asking the prophet for help. Or maybe he thought, well, if he knows that he's talking to the wife of the king, he might not give an accurate appraisal of what this outcome might be. But God came to the prophet Ahijah and said, Jeroboam's wife coming, she's going to try to fool you, kind of the way Jacob did with his dad Isaac with the help of his mother. This is what you're going to tell her. So she comes in, Ahijah, even from the sound of her feet, because he was kind of blind, could tell that it was her, and he says, well, come on in. Why have you come incognito? I do have some difficult things for you. You might want to have a seat and a glass of water. Here's the deal. God's angry with your husband. He tore up the nation, and he gave him the bulk of it and set him king over it. You've been nothing like David. You've been worse than anybody that's come before you. You haven't followed any of my commandments. You've violated the first two of the ten, which are the most important ones, particularly the second one about not creating graven images. And so, basically, at this point, I'm done with you. Every male, both bond and free, will be consumed, just like the cow chips you stick in your fires to cook your meals, which was a normal practice and still is in some very rural areas and parts of the world. And then tells Jeroboam's unnamed wife, go back home, and as soon as you cross the city threshold, your son's going to die. And in verse 13, it's interesting because he's like, now he's the only one worth anything, but he's going to die anyway. I guess that's to make the wrath of God even more complete. There's just no hope. There's no hope. I mean, God is withdrawing the sole hope that they might have had of getting back on the right track, because God is so determined to make Jeroboam and the people he led and who followed him pay the price for these terrible sins. And Jeroboam's dynastic reign will end, not immediately, as it suggests in verse 14, because as we learn later, a son of Jeroboam does assume the throne, Nadab, but it's not going to be long. In verse 15, you begin to see prophecies of conquest and exile. Right now, we're operating sometime in the early 10th century, sort of the 940s. By 732 BC is when the Assyrians will come in, conquer the northern kingdom of Israel, cart the people off in exile to slavery, which is what it's talking about when it's talking about beyond the river Euphrates. The Assyrians controlled areas that would now be Syria, parts of eastern Turkey, the parts of Jordan and northwestern Iraq. And it's because you've made these sacred poles, these Asherim, Jeroboam, you've just infected the entire nation. So this is going to be corporate punishment, which I'm sure we've all suffered from when one kid in the class acts up and the whole class has to write off. I've never forgotten that thing in fourth grade. That was just wrong. I guess the idea was to put peer pressure on him to behave himself. So for God's sakes, Marty, my hand's cramping up. And that actually worked. So she goes back. She crosses the threshold. The child dies. Now you might wonder, why would she? I mean, if the provision is he'll die when you cross the threshold of the city, stay out of the city.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe she didn't believe what the prophet told her. That's a possibility. Or maybe she was simply resigned to the fact that this is going to happen. This is the judgment of God, and if the role I have to play in the death of my oldest son is to simply take a single step. I think that's interesting, sort of that she steps into the city, her son dies, and the prophet can tell it's her by the sound of her footfalls.
Yes.
And I think that's just sort of a very interesting inclusio there. But she does come in, people are distraught that the heir apparent is dead. In verse 19, it indicates that you know, all the other nasty things Jeroboam did is written in a separate book, which we don't appear to have anymore. Thanks be to God. And Jeroboam was in charge for 22 years, and Nadab succeeded him. And then in verse 21, it sort of very abruptly shifts back to the southern kingdom of Judah. Rehoboam, he was 41 when he took charge. He reigned for 17 years. And for some reason, it names his mom twice, one in verse 21 and then one at the end of the chapter in verse 31. It may be her name is less important than the fact that she was an Ammonite. So he was a child of a foreigner. And they weren't much better than Israel because, as we've seen in previous chapters, Solomon had many wives from many different places, including Egypt, and they had sort of brought their own worship practices and idols with them, and Solomon facilitated their continued worship of these false gods by setting up altars and temples and other sacred places, some of them on the Mount of Olives, across a valley from Jerusalem, where they would be, you know, facing the temple itself. And in 24, it talks about male temple prostitutes in the land, which was in some of ancient polytheistic worship, particularly associated with fertility gods and goddesses. One of the temple activities were orgies, which were, I guess, intended to be in some way symbolic of the fertility that was sought. It's sort of polytheistic worship, pantheistic, pantheons of gods are sort of magical in a way, in that you perform what you hope will happen, what will be given by the gods. And so you practice an act that normally would be designed to create children in the hopes that this will be replicated by the god you're worshiping to and providing you with abundant herds and flocks and a good healthy harvest of grain. And so they basically adopted the practices of all the neighboring peoples that God insists that they don't in the Torah. And in the fifth year of King Rehoboam's reign, King Shishak, who has already sheltered two of the people who rose up and became enemies against Solomon, came, plunders the temple precincts, takes all the gold that Solomon has stored up, and it sort of shows you how sorry Rehoboam is. And how far the kingdom has fallen that he can't even replace what he lost with gold. He has to go with the much less valuable bronze. This detail about he gives them to the officers of the guard, and they're carrying him around and everything. In a way, there's this attempt to maintain the facade, but the bronze shields are the symbol that the house of Rehoboam is falling apart. Again, in 29, we're told that Rehoboam did much more, and we put it in this other book, which was lost to us. They're probably going to find it someday, and, you know, yeah, oh boy. I'm sure there's a lot of photos. And there was just constant war between the northern and the southern kingdoms, between Israel and Judah, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Finally, Rehoboam died, and Abijam succeeds him.
Mm-hmm. What's this business about Naamah, the Ammonite, in 31 and then up again?
Yeah, I think that she was mentioned twice, less because of her identity, who she was, the name, more because where she was from, okay. Her ethnicity. Okay. It's a way of emphasizing the fact that the plight that all 12 tribes are in started with Solomon and these hundreds of wives that he had from all over the place, including this Ammonite, who imported their religious views and practices, which Solomon, in contradiction to all the commandments of God, allowed. and his son, his successor, is a child of one of these foreign women. And so there's almost a sense of inevitability in that Rehoboam is, you know, continuing the practices of his father, but also not pulling away and repenting of them. And so the rot is in. I mean, these chapters are foreshadowing the conquest and exile of the northern and the southern kingdoms. The southern kingdom of Judah, it'll take a little bit longer before it completely falls apart. That'll happen round about 587 when the Babylonian Empire will come in from the east. They controlled most of present-day Iraq and Iran, along with some other peripheral territories. And they're going to come in and do to the southern kingdoms what happens to the northern kingdoms a century and a half earlier. The reason Judah holds out longer is because God has a decided preference for the house of David and his descendants. And we'll see that as we continue, that the northern kingdom, with rare exception, is going to have bad king after bad king after bad king, whereas the southern kingdom will have periods where they're going to have, you know, two or three bad kings, then they get a good king for a while, you know. And it's just this special relationship that God had with David and the covenant that he swore to him that God's trying to preserve despite the rank infidelity of the vast majority of David's descendants. And so this is the beginning of the end. And, you know, it takes us back to the establishment of the monarchy, where God said, this is a really bad idea, but give the people what they want anyway, because this will be a teaching opportunity. This is a learning moment for them that's going to last several centuries and going to end in disaster. But this will teach them to never want a king again. And it also seems that God was thinking, well, maybe we'll give it a try and it won't turn out too bad. Maybe the king's life should be faithful. It's their choice. They have free will.
Does this have something to do with about women, I mean, about Jewish women being
yes.
Primogenitor?
Well, yeah, to be considered Jewish, your mother needs to be Jewish. If your father's not, that's okay, that's still kosher. But if you have a Jewish father and your mother's an Ammonite, then you're not really considered to be Jewish. You're not part of the people of the covenant. So
does that go back to this kind of thing here?
Well, arguably even further back, but certainly it's being magnified in this context because Israel was supposed to be distinct.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the law is about. The vast majority of the law is don't do what these other people are doing. Particularly when it comes to who you worship, because that's me and only me. And there's a particular way you're meant to worship me, which is different from everybody else. And so there, a lot of the prohibitions that you see, especially in books like Leviticus and Deuteronomy, are don't be like them. You're supposed to be a very distinctive people. You're to be a light to the nations that will draw all people to me. I mean, the primary purpose of the Exodus was for God's glory to be known to Pharaoh and the people of Egypt and to all the world. The secondary effect of this was that the Hebrew people were released from their captivity. You know, and when they created the golden calf while Moses was on top of the mountain conferring with God, and God, you know, says, I can't believe they've done this, I'm just going to wipe them all out. Moses managed to convince God not to do it by saying, this is really bad PR, because you've already demonstrated your glory and your power to the Egyptians. But if you bring us out into the wilderness just to wipe everybody out but me, then the Egyptians are going to be saying, well, we are very impressed by that God, but we're not really sure that we want to give him a lot of credence, because he liberated his people only to kill them. You know, and that's the type of God that we just might want to stay away from. You know, So, I mean, that's how Moses convinces God to give these people worshiping a golden calf the second chance. He said, it's going to look bad. Judy, and then...
Yeah, it just made me think about at times when the church seems to be conforming to society rather than being a model for society.
Oh, very much so. The church is meant to be distinctive. And, you know, the difficulty is distinctive in what way? Does society sometimes discern what is right in advance of the church, in which case the church is not leading but following because it's behind the curve? So, for instance, women in the workforce began to open up in new ways well before we in the Episcopal Church began ordaining them as deacons, priests, and bishops. And there, most denominations still don't ordain women. And this is a generation and a half after you begin to see women being empowered and enfranchised as equal citizens. You know, those who don't ordain women do so on the basis of a handful of scriptural texts and, you know, the tradition of the church. And they would argue that we are blithely following a corrupt culture where women should stay at home and make babies and take care of their men and obey them. And they shouldn't be doctors or lawyers or accountants. And Bud, you're sleeping on the couch tonight for that one. And Jen, have mercy on him. So to what extent is the church not exercising its prophetic role when it comes to economic injustice? However you want to define that. Whether you want to talk about a living wage, you know, the ability of a person who works a full-time job to be able to have a place to live and access to health care and, you know, pay their bills and eat and things like that. Or maybe the issue is economic inequality. Or maybe it's something different. You know, is capital punishment appropriate? From the biblical witness, very much so. Jesus was executed too. And, of course, he was executed in innocent. So maybe you can apply that to a person who is guilty of a crime, or at least been found guilty of a crime, and has been sentenced to death. You know, where is the church on these issues? And I think that there's a measure of reluctance to weigh in, because within the church itself we have a diversity of opinion, and to be assertive, there's a threat of division with that. Even in something as straightforward as the march in Charlottesville, Virginia, had to be handled delicately. People told me, don't you get up in that pulpit and preach about how Robert E. Lee statues ought to be taken down. Okay. And these are good people, but they just have a different perspective than I do. When it comes to, is it more important to keep these elements of our nation's history, or is it more important to remove them from the public sphere where they're being exploited by hateful racist reactionaries? And in the sermon that I preached on that, that's where I came down. But there are a lot of things that I felt like I couldn't say and have everybody listen, you know, because all it takes is a single sentence to shut a person's ears down, you know. But also part of that sheer cowardice, because I don't want us to lose members over something like that. The church is being meek, but not in the way that Jesus meant for us to be meek when it comes to a whole host of issues that afflict our society and our world. I mean, we're destroying God's creation. You know, believe in global warming or not, the one thing you can't deny is that there is a patch of garbage in the middle of the Pacific Ocean the size of Texas. And most of it consists of plastics that will take thousands of years to degrade and are affecting the marine ecology. You know, we're meant to be the stewards of creation, not the ruiners of it.
It's our greed. We have to have everything. You know, we never have enough. We always want more.
And the sin of greed is one of the things we'll be discussing on Sunday morning, and that's probably going to be one of the more awkward ones, because greed is always somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
You know, you know, because there's always somebody better off than you that has a bigger boat and a bigger house and a fancier car. So, you know, how could you be greedy? This is what greed is really all about. But greed can be not just about material things. I mean, really, gluttony is a form of greed. And even good things can become imbalanced, like the acquisition of knowledge. When I was overseas studying, one of my friends told me about one of his friends who reads. That's what he does. He reads. He doesn't teach. He doesn't write. He just reads. And he would literally, about once a month, have a truck come from Blackwell's Booksellers, which is, if you're ever in Oxford, you've got to go to Blackwell's. It's right there on the high street. And if you love books, it's like going to Disney World. And they have everything. And he would just sit there and read. And so he's amassing all of this knowledge and enjoying himself immensely. And there's nothing wrong with that. But he didn't do anything with it. He didn't share his knowledge. He didn't deploy his knowledge in a way that would benefit others in the world around him. And so in that case, reading was a gluttonous behavior. And I try to be attentive to the fact that, you know, when I read something, I need to find ways of deploying that knowledge in a way that will be a benefit to people. Otherwise, I'm just indulging myself in practicing gluttony when I read. And it also reminds me, when you speak of greed, when I was in Atlanta, the Episcopal Church actually does have a media division. And I don't know if we still have it, but for a long while we had a nationally syndicated hour-long program on radio. And Skip Schudig, who is the head of that, worshipped at the church where I served, and occasionally he would preach, and he told the story of a man that he interviewed when he was talking about materialism in our society. And this was a very affluent man, and Skip asked him, well, but how much is enough? And the man said, more. And Skip asked him again, well, I'm not sure you understood my question. How much is enough? And the man said, more. And Skip, at this point, was kind of in a state of shock, so he asked the same question a third time. Yes, but how much is enough? And Skip said the man looked at him like he was an idiot and just said, more. Well, perhaps not by his reckoning, at least not at that time.
But he didn't have enough?
Yep. Any other comments or questions on chapter 14?
Just one. When it talks in here about how the two kingdoms were constantly at war, what would they have been fighting about when they've got so many enemies surrounding them already?
Well, you know, ain't no fights as fierce as family fights.
Well, okay.
And, you know, you had... essentially two competing claims over who were the real people of God. There's no reason why the border disputes, the greed for land that existed for the neighbors outside of Israelite and Judaic territory would not also be an area of conflict for the east-west boundary that they had, because the tribal areas were, you know, had a general definition, but never a precise definition. I mean, there really wasn't cartography back then, and so it was always debatable which tribe had what. Yeah. Yes.
On the point where the man knew who the person was that came because he couldn't see, mm-hmm. my mother had a friend that was blind, mm-hmm. and she said when they were taught that they could recognize anybody by their footprint, because everybody has, they learn to see with their ears, mm-hmm. because everybody has a different sound with the way they walk. And every time that she went to somebody's house and she was sitting on the porch, she could tell them who was coming up.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when you're deprived of a sense, your other senses become keener. It's just how we adapt.
Before they even knew who it was, she could tell them the person's name.
I mean, I can do the same thing. If I'm sitting in my bedroom reading, I can tell if it's Ben, Emma, or Stephanie coming up the steps on the basis of their footfalls. They're very distinct.
They were taught that when they went to, mm-hmm. to school to learn how to manipulate.
So next week, what time is it? Oh, wait, we've got 10 minutes. I keep forgetting that clock on the wall is fast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peter.
The Egyptians raided, they carried off treasures of the Temple of the Lord.
There's no indication that they did, because almost certainly that would have been mentioned. And yeah, I mean, with its reputation, I could understand why they might decide to leave that behind, because even faithful Israelites, if they touched it, could be struck down. You remember when they were transporting the ark to Jerusalem, they stuck it in a cart, and it was about to fall over, and so to keep it from falling on the ground, some people reached out to scotch it up, and they were killed. You know, the best of intentions, sent you right to the grave, because you just don't mess with anything that's sacred. That's why, you know, there were poles that you would carry it by so you could maneuver it without actually having to touch the ark itself. And of course, you know, looking way down the line, the last straw for the southern kingdom was when they reached out to Egypt, their former oppressors, in an alliance to help protect them from the Babylonian threat, an alliance which proved to be useless and which was the final demonstration that the people had completely abandoned their trust in God's power and goodness to rely on their ancient enemy and oppressor to protect them from a new potential enemy and oppressor. So even this raid from Egypt by King Shishak, Pharaoh Shishak, is a foreshadowing of a change in that relationship. And of course, we've already, I mean, Solomon was married to the guy's daughter. He bought a lot of horses from him, Solomon did, and so it's an inconstant relationship, to say the least. I mean, in this world of proto-states and sort of tribal fiefdoms, opportunism was rife. And you still see this in some cultures. I was reading a fascinating anthropological account of some tribes in New Guinea, indigenous peoples who had a very ritualized way of approaching war and then reconciling to one another after war. And it was all about acquisition of territory, in some cases women or males to be enslaved, pigs, which is sort of the measure of wealth in that society, It doesn't happen anymore because the colonial government eventually forced them to stop doing that in the 60s. But that was a feature of their culture, was regular warfare, defined by a series of rituals. It's a fascinating account. Yeah. So this is just what people did. When we think of war, and perhaps because it's just become so god-awful destructive, we think of, you know, there's got to be a really good reason, you know, to go to war. Well, a really good reason in the ancient world was, I'd like more sheep, please. And I don't like those folks much. That was a perfectly good reason to go to war 3,000 years ago. All right.